Hello there. This is Hubert O'Hearn for the Winnipeg Review, and our guest today is Lauren B. Davis, the author of an absolutely shattering yet wonderful novel called The Empty Room. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you so much, Hubert.
And where do I find you? Are you in Princeton or in Toronto?
Yeah, I'm in Princeton, New Jersey, which is where my husband Ron and I call home these days. I think you probably know I was born in Montreal and then lived in Toronto, lived, you know, different places in Canada. And then we went to France for 10 years and moved here to Princeton in 2004. And I have to say, I love it. Great town.
Fantastic. And I do want to talk to you about the foreign travels a bit, because as you know, I immigrated to England about 2 months ago or so, so we can compare notes on being overseas Canadians. But
absolutely,
yeah. But the book, The Empty Room. What would you like listeners to know about it? And I'll confine my questions to that.
Thanks. Well, it is a speculative look at what my life might have turned out to be had I not quit drinking 18 years ago. And so in some ways it's autobiographical, but it's largely a work of fiction. Because although I'm taking certain facts from my own history and certainly my own perspective of what it means to hit an emotional bottom, nonetheless, you know, much of the stuff in the book certainly didn't happen to me. It's really an idea of where I might have gone, you know, if I'd taken the road less traveled, if you will.
Right. Yeah, and as I said in review I wrote about it, I rarely refer to an author's life in talking about a novel, because generally speaking, if you want to know about the author, read a biography, you know.
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, Somerset Maugham said, you know, writers are not God. We don't create out of nothing. So, you know, in some ways, all books are to one degree or another autobiographical, because we take our experiences of the world. We take what we see, we take what we sense about the world, we take our impressions of the world in many ways, and we bring them into our own minds and sort of let them compost around down in there for however long it takes. And then, of course, when they come back out again, those experiences are not autobiographical in that sense, but in fact they are based on something that we have experienced. I mean, I always think, I think it was R. H. Thompson, the actor, and somebody interviewed him one day and was saying, well, you know, tell me about yourself. And he said, well, why would you want to know that? You know, anything that's interesting about me is in the work.
Well,
I know, it's not in my living room. My living room's actually quite dull. And, I feel the same way. I mean, I live a very probably uninteresting life. Anything that's interesting goes on in my head, I think, and hopefully comes out in the page.
We share a passion for Graham Greene, and I loved it when I read that in your bio. And Greene, of course, in his autobiographies, he played fast and loose with the truth all through them.
Sure.
And
well, I think, you know, it's interesting. Somebody asked me in another interview, you know, do you think that memoir or fiction is a better way of getting at the truth? And I said, well, first of all, I don't think there's any such thing as the truth. You know, there are many truths. You know, there is truth. But I do think that sometimes, at least for me, if you have the kind of mind I do, I don't spend a lot of time pondering my own life, to be honest with you, although I think I spend a good deal of time pondering life in general. But I think that there's something to be said about not letting the facts get in the way of truth. And I always talk about the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. I don't know whether you know the story or not, but you remember that Hitler very famously wouldn't shake hands with Jesse Owens.
Right.
Well, that never happened.
No, really?
That never happened. And in fact, if you go online, you're going to find Jesse Owens himself in later years said, well, it's not quite the way it happened. But what apparently did happen was the day before, there was another African-American athlete who won. And I wish I could remember his name, and I can't. So if his relatives are going to write me letters, forgive me in advance. But I can't remember what his name was. But he was going out to get his award. And Hitler, in those days, was trying to play nice with everybody and still make a good impression on the world. And so was not, you know, the monster that we later knew him to be. But his handler said, you know, you got to get out of here. You got five other things to do. You can't stay. So he left. And a big hue and cry went out that, you know, Hitler walks out on African-American athlete. And so his handlers came back to him and said, okay, now we have a PR problem. You either have to go to everything or you can go to nothing. And he said, oh, then I can't go. I can go only to nothing because I'm far too busy a human being, et cetera, et cetera. So he actually wasn't there the next day when Jesse Owens won his award. But which story tells the truth?
Right, yeah.
That which story tells the truth. And so when I'm teaching writers, and they, you know, they'll turn in a piece of work, particularly this fiction, and it's based on their own lives, and I'll say, you know, this just isn't working, and they'll say, but that's what happened. So yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean it will work for fiction. You know, there's often an underlying truth that we see when we're experiencing something that the facts on the bald face of it cannot reveal. And so that for me is why I've always worked in fiction.
Which, in turn, reminds me of the best 25-cent piece of writing advice that I ever ran across. And that was from Graham Greene, too, where he said that take an episode in your life that you lived and change one detail.
And So, you know, so with Colleen Carrigan, you know, the protagonist in this book, she actually lived in an apartment I lived in. In 1980 when I first moved from Montreal to Toronto.
For curiosity's sakes, what neighborhood were you in? Because I lived in Toronto for a time.
What they call the Davisville neighborhood.
Okay, yep.
There's this whole line of high-rises along Davisville, which in the 80s was, I think, where every single human being lived. In Toronto. I mean, everybody seemed to be, you know, to live in that one row of horrible, well, they're not horrible, but they're not great apartments. And so, you know, for me, there's so much about alcoholism that arrests you emotionally at the place when you started drinking. So I thought, well, what would it be interesting if, you know, here was a woman who just never got past it. You know, that she didn't, you know, her life became locked in, you know, in the amber, if you will, of scotch or whatever it is. And that she just, while the rest of her friends' lives move on, you know, hers just never does. And, you know, sadly, I've seen that in a number of occasions, that people, you know, through addiction in one way or another, that they don't move forward. Other people's lives seem to go on and theirs get stuck. Seems to be particularly with women, but I don't think exclusively so.
Not at all. My late father, God rest his soul, was exactly that.
Yeah. No, I'm really sorry to hear that. That's right.
Yeah.
It's an interesting disease in that, I don't actually know anyone who is not affected by it in some way. Maybe not personally, maybe not in their immediate family, but they work with somebody, or their next door neighbor, or their son's dating a girl. I mean, it's so pervasive. It's interesting when you talk to people, you know, even living in France, where alcohol is looked at somewhat differently, and it's certainly not acceptable to be in recovery. It's not acceptable to be an alcoholic, because there's no such thing in their minds as really in recovery. You're either an alcoholic or you're not. At least it was when we lived there. But because I was quite forthcoming about it, I was astonished at the number of people who would sort of take me aside afterwards and say, oh, yeah, you know, I have a brother, or, you know, I have a cousin, or, you know, my uncle, or, you know, it's just as prevalent there.
Yeah, because if I read the dates backwards, right, and I'm not a whiz on math, you became sober while you were in France.
I did. I mean, and, you know, I think this is not unusual. You know, when I was living in Toronto, you know, I had a job, and, you know, and I went to work every day, and, you know, there was a certain safety that afforded me. you know, I don't think I was a great employee. I don't suppose anybody mourned my loss when I left. But when I arrived in France, you know, here, you know, I am living up in the mountains in the French Alps, and I don't have a job anymore. And so there's no reason, you know, for me to stay sober for any particular hour during the day. And I also had in my mind that, well, it's France. I mean, everybody drinks in France, right? Of course, the truth is everyone does not drink in France. And what's even more true is that women in France, really, unless they have a problem, drink very little. And if someone explained it to me this way, they said that French women do not drink because to get tipsy means, in French culture, that you are sexually repressed. And, of course, no self-respecting French woman is ever going to admit that she's sexually repressed, right? So they, you know, they may have, you know, they will have a glass of wine, but, you know, they'll drink half of it. You know, because I'm drinking the bottle and moving on, right? So I hit bottom there pretty dark liquid.
I was sure the punchline. I was sure the punchline was going to be that French women don't drink because they're around a bunch of drunk guys.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other story. But you know, my days ended up being, you know, sitting around with a bottle of wine and watching reruns of Hogan's Heroes dubbed in French. I mean, you have not lived, you know, until you subjected yourself to that. I'll tell you.
No doubt. Oh, gosh. Yeah, so what was it like for you those 10 years in France and away from Canada? Although I also gather that you must have done the writing course at Humber College at some point during that span.
I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah, with Timothy Finley as my mentor, which was an incredible gift to me. But, you know, I found, you know, it's funny. I have friends who moved to France. And, you know, they said they stepped off the plane and they felt like they were home. You know, that Paris for them was everything. I lived for 5 years in the French Alps and then for 5 years in Paris. And, you know, I understand intellectually why people feel that way about France. I mean, it is one of the most stunningly beautiful places on the planet, no doubt. And yet, I never felt like it was home for me. Interestingly enough, when we went to Ireland, I felt that way when we stepped off the plane in Ireland, or in Scotland, I feel that way, or some parts of England. The northeast coast of England, for me, is heaven. I just feel like I fit there.
That is exactly...
It may have something to do with the gallons of tea I drink every day, I don't know. But in France, there was something about the culture that I just didn't quite fit into. So, in fact, the last... it's also very noisy, and my husband says that there are noises only dogs that his wife can hear, and I'm very, very noise sensitive, which is interesting. Raymond Carver was the same way after he got sober.
Really?
He was an absolute freak about noises, and I'm the same way. I really need quiet. I hear everything, and Paris is an incredibly noisy city, and the French... you know, unlike Canadians who like a fair bit of distance between everybody, you know, the French like to do everything at the same time, all at once, together. So they all go to, you know, they all go to the same restaurants, they all go to you know, vacation in the same place. They like that. It feeds them. And, you know, to me, it's a living hell. It's crowded in with a lot of other people. So the last few years in Paris, we actually got rented a farmhouse out in Normandy. And I spent most of my time up there. And in fact, the Radiant City, which is set in most of the Arab quarters in Paris, was largely written while I was living out in Normandy. So it was a mixed blessing. I mean, in some ways, it was the best thing that ever happened to me because it afforded me the time to get sober and to write, which I had not been able to do for a number of years. The drinking had really taken writing away from me. So I was able to, you know, to get myself back together again. I mean, you know, it's true that wherever you go, you show up and there you are waiting for yourself on the tarmac. And without any of the distractions of the life you know, you really have to sort out things that are going on in your own life, you know, your problems become exacerbated against a foreign background. At least that was my experience.
I quite agree with you. You know, as a matter of fact, I am in the northeast of England.
Oh, where are you? Where are you?
It's Berwick-upon-Tweed.
Oh, my God! I know that place!
We're still at war.
Oh, I know. That's one of my favorite places. I was up at Lindisfarne and Bamburgh Castle and Evering and all of that when I was doing research for another book, and absolutely adore that. You're glad in heaven, my son. That's a great place.
Oh, I am. I am. And I'm in a converted barn, about 3 miles outside of town. I hear no traffic. I hear horses and sheep, period.
Fantastic.
I love it.
Fantastic.
Now, getting back to the writing aspect, there's something about your process that, you write 1,000 words a day, but you also...
The book must go forward 1,000 words a day. So what I do in the morning is I'll come into my office, and I, after walking dog and doing all of that, and I read what I wrote yesterday.
Yep.
And I do that for two reasons. One is to sort of get my head back into where I was, but also to see if any of it works. And, often I'll get rid of it all, which means I'm now writing 2,000 words a day.
Yeah, and in that way, it reminded me very much of Ernest Hemingway's line, because he started every day the exact same way, and the way he put it was that, I dare each word to justify its continued existence on the page.
Right, exactly.
So, the Empty Room, and to listeners, that is available from HarperCollins and at wonderful bookstores. Do go to a bookstore as opposed to ordering everything online. Your fourth novel, it took you a while to get to this topic. Was it hard to actually write about the Here But For the Grace of God Go I book?
Well, at this point it wasn't. I mean, as I say, I've been sober for 18 years. I would not have written this book before. I think it's quite dangerous to write this sort of thing too early. Probably because it takes a long time to figure out who you are. I mean, I'm one of those people who spends a lot of time in church basements with other people trying to get sober. And, everybody comes in and they want 10 years sobriety later today. And, the way you get 10 years sobriety is you stay sober for 10 years. But the way the world looks in those first few years is very different than the way it looks later on. I mean, your perspective is very different once the brain sort of heals up from all of that abuse. And I don't think I had the objectivity, nor do I think I had the understanding, really, of why I thought the way I did, of what was going on in my mind until now. I could not have written it earlier. And I also think there's a danger, because you are, when you write a book like this, you are to an extent putting yourself out there. And there's a kind of danger in that, because you're never going to get all terrific reviews. People are going to get it, other people are not going to get it. And that kind of rejection about something that's relatively personal can be emotionally upsetting. It can send you off the beam a little bit, and that's not something you want if you're trying to stay sober in the early days. But also, I'm very protective about the method by which I got sober. And, my concern would be, let's say I'd written this book at, 2 years sober, 3, 4, 5 years sober, but I hadn't stayed sober.
Right.
Then what people would say was, well, look, whatever she's doing, see, it doesn't work.
Right.
Without understanding that the problem would have been in me and not in the program or methodology I use to get sober. So you have to be aware of that. I mean, I'm not saying now that I can absolutely guarantee that I will never have a drink again. But I'm pretty confident I'm going to get through the rest of today, okay? Just because it's been so long now, and because I've learned how to get through a day sober.
Did you ever worry? And this may be an odd question, in letting a gap of 15, 16 years go by. Did you ever worry that you'd forget what it was like?
It's a good question. I work pretty hard not to forget that, because I think that's dangerous too. And the one thing that I will say about the process of writing this book, which was very different than writing any other book that I've done, you know, this book kind of came out fully formed. It took me 3 months to get a first draft out.
Wow.
Which is crazy. Then, of course, it took me several more months to fill it all out, and probably a year and a half in total. But most books take me a year or two even to get a first draft out that I think I've got the foundation for. But the one thing that this book gave me really reinforces a sense of gratitude. Mm-hmm. Because looking back and thinking, oh my God, what would have happened? Well, I wouldn't have had this, and I wouldn't have done that, and that would never have happened, and oh my God, it really, really filled me with gratitude, which is part of one of the tools that I use to stay sober every day. It's just incredibly grateful for where you are, to recognize that this would not be where you were had you not stopped drinking.
Right, right, I hear you. You're involved in another project I find fascinating. When I was in university, I used to go and read to prisoners in Kingston. You teach writing to
many students. Yeah, I do. I'm not actually teaching there at the moment. There was a problem at the prison, which happens sometimes. So I'm not going into the same prison right now, but I am doing other things in the community at different prisons where I go in, once a month or once every couple of months and work. But yeah, for quite a while there, I was teaching a class once a week in a men's penitentiary here in New Jersey. And I can say I loved it. I loved it. And, there's remarkable young men in the class. I mean, it was a tough prison. They were all, gang members, all from the Bloods gang, the Crips, their opposing gang in this area, for obvious reasons, they sent to a different prison. It was quite fascinating. I was both really saddened to see just how much waste of human life there is and human talent there is in these places, and also, stonish at the talent, and you know, it just had great these guys were. Yeah. So when he's stupid in many cases, but you know, but great guys nonetheless. And it's interesting, you know, somebody said to me, you know, aren't you afraid of, you know, aren't you afraid of them, and what are you doing hanging around those people? And I said, well, what do you mean by those people? You know, who are we referring to here, right? Which was in fact the theme of Our Daily Bread, you know, what happens when we view our neighbors as the other, as those people. And given where most of these guys come from and the experiences they had, I expect that had I been there and saw what they saw and learned what they learned, you know, I would be in exactly the same place they were. You know, there's no difference in our moral core in the center of that. It's quite fascinating to me.
Oh, truly. Truly. You know, a baby is born anywhere, and the baby wants one thing. It wants love. Okay.
Yeah.
And that poor kid or lucky kid is born into a certain environment where maybe love is or love isn't, and there's all kinds of distractions. Of you, you're right. You know, we can't look at anyone and say, "Well, I wouldn't have done that." Well, no, you didn't lead his or her life, you know, at all.
Well, yeah, you have no idea. I mean, do you know who Jean Vanier is?
No.
Jean Vanier is he's a Catholic priest. He's from Quebec, and he started up these houses called Les Arches, the Arcs, where people with severe physical and mental challenges live in community with quote unquote normal people. But the idea is that this is our house. It's not my house in which you live. This is our house. We live in community together. Quite a remarkable thing that he did. But he wrote an autobiography and he talks about working with prisoners on death row.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, you know, he realized there was this young boy that they had brought home to live with him. He was, I think, in his early 20s, and he was paralyzed, he was deaf, he was mute, and blind. And the only care that he'd ever had in his entire life had been his mother. Mm-hmm. And his mother had now died.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had taken him in. But of course, how do you explain to this person who has mental challenges? You know, his IQ is very low. He's lived in a world that the only thing he understood was the smell and touch of this one human being who is now gone. I mean, how do you explain that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's no, this wasn't somebody like Helen Keller who had, a sterling mind. This was not the case. And so he was living in the house. They brought him to the home, and he started to make this sound, this horrible, unending, sort of nonverbal, kind of keen, awful, horrible noise. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't stop. I mean, it went on and on and on and on and on. And Jean Vanier says, there was a point at which all he wanted to do was go in and put a pillow over this kid's face. And he said the only thing that stopped him was that if he did that, he would no longer be able to be here. Because we don't do that. The people in this community didn't do that.
Yeah.
But he said, what would happen if he lived in a community where they did do that? And he said at that moment he understood that there was absolutely no difference between him and the people on death row that he worked with. Yeah. It was merely a matter of circumstance.
It's true. It's true.
I never forgot that.
It's so true. You know, the addicts like Colleen, we see it with the disabled and so forth, where we shut them off. You know, we ignore them, like it's quite literally, go to your room. I don't want to see you anymore.
Yeah, they are not us.
Right, right.
And so this, of course, happens with Colleen as well. She is, she has become marginalized. And even the people in her life who are fond of her, her friend, the people with whom she works, she can't see that any longer. Her perception is so altered.
That you captured brilliantly. The defensive aspect of the alcoholic and turning to attack, turning to sarcasm, hiding into fantasy. That is genius writing, Lauren. It truly is.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. Well, it was funny. There was I can't remember who the reviewer was, but somebody said, all these flashbacks, I don't think I like them. And I thought, I thought, oh gosh, have I failed? Because in fact, if they're not really flashbacks, this is what this woman carries in her head all the time. These running loops of self-justification and blaming others and that's what goes on in the mind of an alcoholic. And part of what I wanted to accomplish with this book was, this one, certainly for the alcoholic to see that they're not alone in what may be going on in their minds, because although the circumstances of all of our lives are different, there's a sort of, an essence, there's a default position for an alcoholic that, they think that they're an active alcoholic at any rate, that they think that nobody understands what they're thinking, nobody gets it, when in fact, pretty much the same, I'm afraid. But also, I wanted to offer an opportunity to the people who are not alcoholic, but who live with or have to deal with alcoholics, to see what's happening in the mind.
Yeah.
Because it seemed, I remember my husband, just the most wonderful guy in the world, and I remember him looking at me, he baffled, utterly baffled. What on earth are you doing? Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And he could not understand what was going on in my mind. And I worked quite hard, I must say, on trying to get that right. So if that came across to you, I'm really, really grateful to hear it.
You nailed it, because, it's how we operate, whatever I'll do after we sign off and find, and I turn off the recorder, well, what am I going to do next? And what I'm going to think is that, well, what would I have done before? And even on very minor things like that, we base our decisions on the future based on what we've done in the past. And on very large things, we always do, especially on a very traumatic day like what your character Colleen does, Oh. You nailed it, kid.
Thank you very much. No, I'm really grateful to hear that. I saw Stephen King being interviewed the other day, and he's got this show on TV I don't know whether you've heard about it, called the Dome, and it's, you know, it's classic Stephen King, you know, yeah. Little tiny small town, great big dome comes over the town, and now what happens? But he said that he always writes about the same thing. What happens to ordinary people under pressure?
Yeah.
Right? And I thought that's really interesting, because in a way, that's what I tried to create for Colleen. I mean, in some ways, this day is, you know, the Groundhog Day from hell. It's the day that just keeps repeating itself. She's had this very day, mm-hmm. probably forever. And yet there has to be that one thing
yeah.
that makes this day unlike all others. And that, of course, is that she's lost her job.
Yeah.
You know, very early in the book, we learn that, you know, certain people are just not going to tolerate her behavior. They're not going to overlook it before. And I, you know, I remember a dear friend of mine and a rather famous writer, he will not be named, but he said to me one day, he said, you know, how do you not drink? How do you get through a day and not drink? And I said, well, you know, I go to these church basements and there are other people there and they help. And he said, oh, I could never do that. And I said, why not? And he said, well, because they know I was an alcoholic. And I'm thinking, honey, everybody knows you're an alcoholic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the whole world knows you're an alcoholic. Who do you think you're hiding this from?
Yeah, yeah.
But he could not see that. He could not see that. And you know, and that's what I also wanted to get to with, you know, with Colleen. I mean, when she goes into the office and her, you know, her boss says, you know, we can't have this anymore. She's like, what do you mean? Have what? I said, well, you did this thing, you know, where she makes an inappropriate gesture to, you know, to yeah. one of the professors in the university where she works. And she thinks, did I do that? Well, yeah, I might have done that. You know, but how could you fondle the buttocks of a university professor in front of the students
yeah.
and think that nobody noticed that?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens with an alcoholic.
Oh, God, yes. God, yes. You know, and even her choice of drinks, wine and vodka, you know, because I've known alcoholics and they think that, well, vodka doesn't smell. Oh, yes, it does. And wine,
of course, it does.
And wine, of course, is classy and social. You know, right. I'm having a dinner party.
Right. Perfect. Yeah, I'm not drinking vanilla. Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
God. Lauren, I'll have to wrap this up. You've been a joy to talk with, and I truly urge the listeners to pick up a copy of the Empty Room. As I say, it's a shattering book, but by God, it's fascinating, wonderfully written.
Well, thank you so much, and you're very easy to talk to. Am I right in understanding this is the first podcast you've done?
Oh, I've done them before for the San Francisco book review.
Good. Okay. Yeah. So I was going to say you don't sound like this is the first one you've ever done. You're very easy to talk to.
So how many words are there in the book? Yeah, right. Anyway, you've been a joy, and if you're ever in England, do drop on by.
Oh, you know I'm going to.
Fantastic, Lauren. Take care.
Bye.